Sour cream and chives. Think I'm gonna find a way to put that on my office door. So awesome. I don't know if those two girls are gonna be at camp, but if they are, if there's a way they could sing that at camp, that would be awesome. Again, I don't know if they're both going to be there, but I'm going to tell Mark Gray that they need to sing one of the evening services, because it's way easier to preach after great singing like that. And I tell you, man, gets me fired up. That was good. Thank you, girls, for that. Brother, I didn't tell you this morning whenever you were teasing me about being a quarterback from New York Giants. I wanted to be a quarterback whenever I was a teenager, and I could throw. I could throw well, not to toot my own horn. But I'm so glad that God called me to do this. Because it's way better. It's way better. Well, man, it has been such a great time getting to be with each and every one of you in this church. We've been just, the fellowship with you has been sweet. The time here in this church has been wonderful. We're so grateful that we've had the opportunity to come and just get to be a part for just a short period of time. We're heading home tomorrow. We're not looking forward to it, if I'm honest, mostly because it's a long drive. But then just saying goodbye. Goodbyes always stink, and I'm not a huge fan of them, that's for sure. But we're looking forward to coming back again. We're already making plans to come back. Matter of fact, I've already been given medicine so that as I start getting ready this next year, she's looking out for me, you know, making sure I got what I need so I'm not too sore. No, we're looking forward to coming back, and hopefully we'll get to do rim to rim. That's what I'd like to do. Brother Ben's like, yeah, right, we'll see. But I want to. It'll be great to get to come back. Brother David, I noticed your cup, though. And I'm a bit worried about him, so he's an Ohio State fan. Apparently they know. So... What I found out was Brother Chris was willing to part with his teddy bear. It's a baby Yoda with a Michigan, whatever this is, that was knitted for him. This is what Brother Chris cuddles with every night. If we can't laugh in church, we can't laugh anywhere. We as the people of God have an opportunity to be joyful, and we ought to be able to just laugh together. I love it. I love it. It's good. Well, tonight we're going to be in Mark chapter 16. Tonight, don't stand just yet. Tonight's message is going to be a missions message. And I did not, actually getting ready for all this, I was not actually aware that we were going to have the auction tonight, getting ready for camp. I love it. I love getting to be here for that. It's exciting. It's exciting for me just to get to see how this is all going to work out and such. And it is a bit rude, though, to put the food right behind the preacher. Although it's a great way to make sure the message is shorter. So, because, you know, I could smell a little bit of it, and there's some good-looking stuff. There's actually a lot of great-looking stuff back there. So, but the tonight, with the fact that we're going to have a missions message, you being a part of helping your young people go to camp, and I guess potentially even youth con this summer, maybe, but you helping these young people go to camp, believe it or not, is a missions effort of some sort. Because the truth is, it could be that someone you send to camp this coming summer will be the next pastor of this church. It could be that someone that you help sponsor, that you help send to camp this coming summer, goes and reaches to the other side of the world, goes to the other side of the world, could even be your own child or grandchild, goes to the other side of the world with the gospel because they know that the Lord has called them to do this. But One of the things with missions that I think is very important to recognize is that it's not just about sending. It's about we ourselves going. So we're going to take a look at Mark chapter number 16 tonight. I know whenever we think of missions, there's multiple passages that come to mind. Matthew chapter number 28. Verses 19 and 20. We know those by heart, I'm sure, and we know it as the Great Commission that God gave, that Jesus gave to the disciples. And Acts chapter number 1, verse number 8 of Acts 1, in many ways you could call the scope of missions. Mark chapter 16, which is where we're going to be tonight, verse number 15 is in many ways you could call this the synopsis of missions. It kind of echoes the Great Commission, but it's a little bit more condensed. And so we would call it the synopsis of missions. There are obviously many others. We can go back and even begin to build a theology of missions all the way back in the book of Genesis and go from there. But tonight we're going to take a look at Mark chapter 16. And it's funny, sometimes we have verses that we're very familiar with, but we don't know or we're not as familiar with the context of what is going on around those verses. So we're going to take a look at that tonight, as I really believe that there's something very important for you and I tonight. So if you'll stand in honor of the reading of the Word. We're going to begin in verse number 9. Now when Jesus was risen early the first day of the week, he appeared first to Mary Magdalene, out of whom he had cast seven devils. And she went and told them that had been with them, as they mourned and wept. And they, when they had heard that he was alive and had been seen of her, rejoiced and were exceeding glad. No, that's not what it says. Notice what it actually says. Believed not. After that, he appeared in another form unto two of them as they walked and went into the country. And they went and told it unto the residue, neither believed they them. Afterward, he appeared unto the 11 as they sat at meat and upbraided them with their unbelief and hardness of heart, because they believed not them which had seen him after he was risen. And he said unto them, go ye into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature. He that believeth and is baptized shall be saved, but he that believeth not shall be damned. Can I just point out a really big oddity here? Jesus just chews them out for their unbelief. And then he says, now I want you to go. When I read that, I was... what? Jesus, you just chewed them out for not believing. I believe that there's something very important here for you and I tonight. Let's take a look at this. Dear Heavenly Father, I ask God that you would just work as only you can in this service, Lord. We're so grateful for just the way the service has unfolded, the singing, Lord, the specials, and even the opportunity to take time just to praise you, Lord, for the different blessings that have come into our life, and even just to praise you for how good you are to us. And God, I ask now, Lord, is with all of these things in mind, Lord, that we would just come before you, Lord, with hearts that are ready to hear and that are hungry to hear from you. And God, I ask that you would just, Lord, help me to have clarity, Lord. You just remove me, Lord, and may you be glorified. May you be central to all that takes place. God, work as only you can. And Lord, we look forward to what you will accomplish tonight. In Jesus' name, amen. You may be seated. I preached this. I was actually in the process of preparing this message for a missions conference I preached back in February. And this missions conference was down in southwestern Kansas. It's actually in four different churches. So southwestern Kansas as well as southeastern Colorado. And as I was thinking through my introduction, what I was going to do, I had not considered where we were going to be as I come up with this introduction. If you know anything about southwestern Kansas, what would you say it probably is known for? Farming? farming. I mean, the cattle, you name it, farming, that it is, they are very strong agricultural, very strong farming communities, wonderful churches that we had the privilege of being in. So when I ask this question, you're going to chuckle, but like, you are dumb. So here's the question. How many of you have heard the term to farm out or farming out something? It's a common term. It's a term that I'm sure that every one of us are familiar with in some form or another. But the idea, the phrase itself, to farm out something, comes from as far back as apparently the 1600s when I was kind of doing some research into this. And the idea, of farm out really is this, that you would have a landowner who would contract with another person who would farm their land for them, and then that landowner would then profit from the work that was done on the land. That's what it means to farm it out, that you would have some kind of wealthy landowner who would pass off the hard work, the hard toil, the responsibility of getting out and planting, digging and all the things that are involved with farming. You can tell I'm not a farmer. You can tell I don't know a ton about farming. Farming is in my family blood. On both sides of our family, we have farmers. But I've never had the privilege of doing it myself. But the idea is that you would have a landowner who would pass that off. He would contract with somebody else who would do all of that hard work, and then he would profit from the work that was done. That's what it means to farm out, at least the original meaning. Today, we would know there's that phrase, and that idea is still very much in use. I love baseball. Okay, I guess a couple people do, a couple people don't. Now, what I'm about to say, please don't throw tomatoes, okay? I'm a Cubs fan. Okay, that was a better response than I've received in a while. That was good. I'll take a little bit of booze. That's fine. I'm a Cubs fan. I enjoy watching the Cubs play. I enjoy watching baseball. Opening day this year, I made sure it was an office day of work. And then I had my office work and then opening day games going. It was great. I enjoy baseball. In the baseball world, everybody's familiar with the Major League Baseball teams. Here you have the Arizona Diamondbacks, who the Cubs beat last week. If you didn't get to see the game, it was real. There was one specific game that was pretty epic. You know, I know I probably lost somebody. I am sorry. So you have the Arizona Diamondbacks, obviously, here. Up in our neck of the woods, we have the Colorado Rockies, who nobody really knows about because they're terrible, and we might as well not have a baseball team up there. And then, obviously, you know, I lived in Chicago for a period of time, so I'm a Cubs fan. So the Major League Baseball teams, obviously, are what everybody's really focused on, but every Major League Baseball team has their minor league teams. And the minor league teams, it's called the farm system. It's where you would have different teams in other cities that aren't at the same level as the major leagues, but they would put these players into these different teams, and these minor league teams would then do the hard work of cultivating talent so that eventually they could come up and play first base or play catcher, whatever position it would be, in the majors. Sometimes you would even have it where you would have an injury that would take place in the major leagues, and so they would send somebody down into the minor league system or the farm system to cultivate, to you know, just work out the kinks and to get them ready to come back, if you will. Major League Baseball, in many ways, they farm out the responsibility of the hard work of cultivating these players so that they could hopefully one day benefit and profit from the work that is done within the different teams there. Where I grew up in Tulsa, Oklahoma, we have the Tulsa Drillers. I think that they are a farm team. They're a double-A team for the Dodgers today. I could be wrong on that. But we used to go and watch them. And as a kid, it was a big deal. It was like, this is exciting. But the Tulsa Drillers at that time, whenever we would watch them, they were cultivating the players to eventually send them up either to AAA or ultimately to whatever team they were the feeder team, the farm team for. That's one aspect of farming out a responsibility. Another aspect of farming out a responsibility would be kind of like a business needing to develop a website. And so rather than try to find somebody in the business who may know how to do a website, they'll farm out that responsibility to develop a website, and they don't have to do the hard work, but they'll profit from having someone do the work for them. They'll farm out that responsibility. I think you understand the general gist of what it means to farm things out, to farm out a responsibility. This idea of farming out a responsibility, though, isn't limited to the business world or to the agricultural world. Obviously, it could really be found anywhere. Can I just, as an aside, say this much? Farming out responsibilities can sometimes take place within families. Here's what I mean by that. It's becoming more and more common, it seems like, that parents will farm out their responsibility to parents, their children, to school systems, to youth groups, to sports teams, to Boy Scouts or Girl Scouts, to whatever group, whatever it may be, they would farm out their responsibility to do the hard work of disciplining their children, to do the hard work of shepherding their children's hearts and their children's lives. That they would farm out the responsibility that they should be doing themselves to someone else. I know that because I was a youth pastor for 11 years. And I can't tell you how many times there would be conversations that would arise where a parent would be frustrated, or it would be evident a parent was frustrated that I was not fixing their child. And that was the problem. They were farming out their responsibility, expecting me to fix their child. When in many ways, the discipline that needed to take place was at home. The youth group is to work in conjunction with reinforcing what is going on in the home, but it is not meant to replace the home. The church was never to replace the home.
Yes, correct.
And so the idea of farming out could take place even in areas like church, like families, where you would have parents who would farm out the hard work of cultivating their children's lives, of doing the hard work of disciplining their children and of helping them to mature and of helping them to grow. They would farm that responsibility out to someone else. And we know this is true because look at the public school systems. I'm not criticizing the public school system alone, but if you were to walk into any public school system, the chaos that exists in the lives of the young people is incredible. And it happens because parents are farming out their responsibility to others rather than taking the responsibility for themselves. But can I ask a question that I think is really important for you and I to consider? Is it possible for you and I to farm out our spiritual responsibilities? I believe it is. I believe it's very possible for you and I to farm out our spiritual responsibilities. In our passage in Mark chapter number 16, if you've ever read through the book of Mark, you'll know that just before this, in chapter 15, Jesus has just been crucified. And just before this, a cruel death, the kangaroo court and everything that led to his crucifixion. We all knew it was coming. We all knew that it was part of the story, that it was part of God's plan. But all that takes place in chapter 15. And chapter 15 ends with Jesus there on the cross. It ends with Jesus being put into the tomb. But for the reader who's been going through the book of Mark, they would know that on four separate occasions, Jesus has already foretold the fact that he was going to die and that he was going to be crucified. But then he also foretold the fact that he was going to rise again. That he promised that that was getting ready to happen. And so as the reader or even anybody who's ever listened to preaching from the book of Mark, really as you come to chapter number 16, you can't help but come to the chapter number 16 with excitement saying, okay, when's it going to happen? How's it going to happen? He's dead. He's been put into the tomb, but he's promised us that he's going to rise again. And it's with that anticipation that we should approach chapter number 16. And it's with even that anticipation that the disciples and all of his followers should have had in their hearts as they're waiting for this incredible moment whenever Jesus is going to rise again just as he promised. So at the very beginning of chapter 16, we're told of two women that begin to make their way to the tomb. And they're making their way to the tomb armed with spices because they are intending to anoint the body of Jesus. Can I just make a duh statement? You don't go to anoint a body that's not there. And yet here they are, they're on their way anticipating that Jesus is still going to be in that tomb. They're anticipating that he is still going to be there. And so they're on their way to anoint the body, to anoint the dead body of the one that they love. And we also know that this is true because along the way, there's even maybe a discussion about how they're going to roll back the stone to be able to go inside. Because the stone that is covering the tomb is rather large, and maybe they're concerned. And maybe the question went something like, or the conversation went something like this: maybe we could ask one of the Roman soldiers, maybe they'll help us roll it back so we can get inside. And so here they are, they're armed with the spices, they're even questioning among themselves how they're going to roll back the stone, because ultimately they're expecting Jesus to be in there. So as they get closer to the tomb, last week was Resurrection Sunday, the day of days for Christians. I mean, it's just, Christmas is great. Resurrection Sunday is awesome. Anyway, they're walking towards the tomb, arms laden with the spices, and as they get near the tomb, they see the stone is rolled back. I can't help but picture that all of a sudden everything that they were carrying was dropped, and they began to run to the tomb. I would run, but it would look really awkward because I'm hurting. They began to run towards the tomb. And they get there, and they bust inside, and they're immediately met with a man. They're immediately met with a messenger from the Lord who's there. And notice what happens. And when they looked, they saw that the stone was rolled away, for it was very great. You can't miss it. It was evident that the stone had been rolled back. And so they entered into the sepulcher, and they look what it says. They saw a young man sitting on the right side, clothed in a long white garment. And they were affrighted. So immediately, as they run into the tomb there, they're met with a young man, a young-looking man, I guess. They're met with a man, though, who's there. And he's an evident messenger from God, as we're going to see in a minute. And immediately, they're scared. I don't know necessarily why they're scared, but they're scared. Because this isn't the way it should be. And notice what he tells them. In verse number 6. And he saith unto them, be not affrighted. Ye seek Jesus of Nazareth, which was crucified? He is risen. He is not here. What in the world could you imagine running into the tomb expecting? I mean, because remember, they are in their minds on the way to anoint the body of Jesus. They're expecting him to be there. That is why they're headed there. They're having conversation. Maybe there's even a somber tone or somber approach to the tomb. Just mournful hearts as they're on their way. And just wondering and what, you know, just maybe hurting inside their hearts. And they get there and they see that the stone is rolled back. And they run in there. And the messenger who's there, The one who's sitting there in the tomb is not him. And the one who's sitting there says, hey, you're seeking Jesus of Nazareth, right? He's not here. He is risen. Now, No preacher worth his salt is going to skip this. Now, this is just a side note. This part is free when I'm about to preach, okay? You don't have to, yeah, anyway. When it comes to the resurrection, child of God, this ought to be one of the most exciting parts for you and I, because this is what we so desire. This is what we need. This is why Jesus came. Because you see, Jesus came here on this earth. He lived a perfect, sinless, spotless life so that he could then suffer a cruel, cruel death there on the cross, taking your condemnation, taking my condemnation, taking the rejection that should have been mine from God. He took that upon himself, and taking your rejection that should have been yours. Because if you remember, Jesus is my God, why hast thou forsaken me? My friend, that should have been us. That should have been us who should have been forsaken. And yet Jesus takes that upon him. He takes our condemnation. He takes our punishment. He takes our sin upon him. And then he dies there on the cross. Therefore, our condemnation died with him. Our shame died with him. Our punishment died with him. But it didn't stop there, because Jesus promised that he was going to come back, that he was going to rise again. And so 3 days later, we find that he does rise again. Not just taking our condemnation, not just taking our punishment, but giving us new life, because he not only died, but rose again victorious over sin, death, and hell. It's an exciting moment for the child of God, and ought to thrill our hearts as we would read even just those simple words, "He is risen, he is not here." It ought to be on the tongues of each and every one of us. Who cares if we sound like a cult? Because some people are probably like, "What? Those people are weird. It's talking about he is risen. Why are they saying that?" Because it's everything. It's everything for us. He is risen. He is not here. Notice what the messenger says next. "Behold the place where they laid him." So not only does he tell them the truth, he then has them witness for themselves the fact that he is not there. He doesn't stop there. He then says this, "But go your way, tell his disciples and Peter." Now that's an interesting note. We'll get to that later on. "And Peter, that he goeth before you into Galilee." Again, another interesting note. Jesus, the last time he foretold of his death, promised them, told them that he was going to go before unto Galilee to meet them. So we're seeing all of this adding up. We're seeing all of this where he is faithful. Everything that he's promised is being fulfilled. Everything he has said was going to happen is happening. And now here he is. He's going to meet them in Galilee. And so he says that he goeth before you into Galilee. There ye shall see him as he said unto you. Notice their response. "And they went out quickly and fled from the sepulchre, for they trembled and were amazed. Neither said they anything to any man, for they were afraid." The greatest news that they could ever have witnessed, much less have been told, and they were silent. Notice what comes next. "Now when Jesus was risen early the first day of the week, he appeared first to Mary Magdalene." So in the other Gospels, we find that Mary makes her way up to the garden. She's wondering, she's meditating, she's wondering what has happened to Jesus. Matter of fact, she even runs into Jesus there in the garden and believes him to be the gardener, asking for him to tell her where they laid the body, or where they took the body, because she just wants it back. And whenever Jesus begins to speak unto her, she suddenly recognizes that it's him. And she wants to hug him. There's so much there. We can't re-preach all of that. We'd love to, but we don't have time. And so immediately then we find that she goes back. She goes back into the disciples. Now, I'm not a girl, as is evident, yes. You're like, where did that come from? I don't know how to rejoice like a girl, okay? But I can't help but picture that as she runs into the room with the disciples, that there's this, you know, bouncing up and down and clapping and squealy high voices. I saw him. He's alive. It's true. He's really there. And I mean, she's just excited. Hair's going everywhere. Her eyes are as big as saucers. I mean, she is excited. And she's, you know, bouncing up and down. And typical manly response, Mary, are you off your rocker? They don't believe her. She's telling them that he is alive. The very thing, I want to remind you, the very thing that they should have been anticipating, because he promised them four separate times that he was going to rise again. He promised them four separate times that this was coming. And so they should have been anticipating this. They should have been like with excitement. When is it going to happen? When are we going to hear the news? I mean, I would like to think that I would have. Unfortunately, it's likely that I would have been one of the disciples. But here she goes, she runs in there and she tells them the news that they should have been anticipating. And she's excited. She's jumping up and down for joy. And they're all probably saying, Mary, have you gone back to your old ways? Are you off your rocker? Have you been eating the mushrooms back in the garden? I mean, what is wrong with you, Mary? This is not, no, no. And they did not believe her. The next story that Mark records for us and in the Gospels elsewhere, we have two of the disciples on their way to Emmaus. And Jesus appears unto them and they're talking amongst themselves, just disappointed by what is going on, but at the same time a bit confused about the news that is coming to them. And so along the way, Jesus begins to expound unto them the Scriptures, beginning back in the law, and making his way through the whole of the Old Testament, pointing out and connecting how that Jesus was the Messiah, the one that they were waiting for, and that what has just happened was what God had intended, and everything that happened was all part of God's plan. And so Jesus is telling them that. I just wish, sometimes whenever I read these stories, sometimes I just wish I could have been one of those disciples. Having Jesus expound the whole of the New Testament, or the whole of the Old Testament, and ultimately say, don't you see that that was me? Now, he never said that, but he was showing them from the Old Testament how Jesus was the Messiah. It wasn't, though, until they get to the house that he breaks bread. And as he breaks bread and gives it to them, that all of a sudden, they understood. They knew who he was, and yet he was gone. He was completely gone. And so those two disciples, their response, they immediately hoof it back, cramping legs and cramping calves the whole way back to Jerusalem, because it was some distance, and they would have run. I picture them bursting into the room there with the disciples, both out of breath, kind of like Barney Fife whenever he gets all keyed up and excited. And we saw him, and he was... And the disciples are like, whoa, guys, whoa, whoa, what are you talking about? We walked with him. He's alive. He told us the whole Scriptures. Well, our hearts burn within us. I mean, it was an incredible moment. It was, Jesus is alive. It's true. What Mary wasn't off a rocker. She was telling us the truth. Jesus is alive. And notice what their response was. And neither believed they them. Now, I want you to note something very quickly here. During this time in Israel, if you had two or three witnesses, three specifically being a very strong number, that legally would have held up in court as being factual. So here they have all of the proof that they need just from these three sources alone that, hey, it's true. He's alive. And yet they believed her not. The disciples are all mourning and weeping, all sad. They're gathered in the room, and suddenly Jesus appears in their midst. Can you imagine? The one you're mourning, the one you love, who you just watched die a horrible, horrific death, is suddenly standing in your midst. He appears unto them. That word is intentional, that he appeared unto them. The 11, as they sat eating, doing what Baptist men typically do whenever they're sad, and when they're happy, and when they're in between. And and Jesus upbraided them. To use just modern vernacular or language, he chewed them out. Notice what he says, for their unbelief and hardness of heart. Why? Because they believed not them which had seen him after he was risen. That's an interesting note. You're saying, well, it makes sense that Jesus would chew them out for this. But I want you to get what happens next. Jesus chews them out for their hardness of heart and for their unbelief because they failed to believe the witnesses. The witnesses who witnessed the fact that Jesus was alive. And can I point out what has been taking place since the beginning of Mark chapter number 16? You have had someone with a message proclaim the good news to someone. And then the expectation was that that person would then go and proclaim the good news themselves. And that it would be received and that it would be believed. And that life that was changed as a result of that news would then go, and that they would then tell, and that it would continue to spread, and it would continue to spread. And yet when it gets to the disciples, what happens is it stops dead in its tracks. And Jesus chews them out. And then his next words to them were, now I want you to go. I want you to tell. It's unusual, but I want you to get what I think, I really believe that is going on, that Jesus is ultimately trying to do, and what God's ultimately trying to do with the book of Mark, or this section of Mark, that he's trying to highlight through the unbelief of the disciples that his intended way, that he intends for the gospel to go forth is by witnesses proclaiming the good news, proclaiming the gospel from person to person. And as the lives are changed and as they become witnesses of the fact that he is in fact alive, that person would then go and tell. And as that person would then receive and believe, that person would then go and tell. And that God's intention for the gospel, that God's intention for the good news wasn't that he was going to put some kind of big screen in the air. He wasn't going to use some biplane with a flag behind it that says Jesus is risen. That he wasn't going to use TV. He wasn't going to use movies. He wasn't going to use great miracles. He was going to use the personal witness of people whose lives have witnessed the fact that he is in fact alive, that he did in fact change my life, and that life would then go and that they would tell and they would proclaim the good news. And that's what God intended all along the way. And that by their unbelief, he's ultimately highlighting and saying, hey, boys, you're messing up what I am intending for you now from this point. Because the truth is, boys, I'm getting ready to leave. I'm not going to be here forever. I'm getting ready to leave. And the way that this message is supposed to continue out, and the way that this message is supposed to go, is by you going and telling others the fact that I have risen again. And that's what God intends. That's what Jesus intended for the disciples. And can I just point out who the disciples were? They're the first church. These are the first church. It didn't happen later. It happened here. It was all. These were the guys. These were the first church. So can we just then point out who this command then was made to? You and I. When he says this, notice this. We get hung up on words sometimes. Words freak us out. It's true. Words freak us out. Because we see this, go into all the world and preach. Okay, well, that's easy. That immediately eliminates me. I mean, it makes sense for the disciples because every one of them, they all end up becoming pastors and missionaries who go all over the place. And so that's very easy for them. But remember, that's never qualified here. And when we see the word preach, we think, well, that's for Pastor Moore. That's for Brother Joe. That's for you fill in the blank for maybe the person who's intended to get behind that pulpit, to get behind that wonderful sacred desk and begin to proclaim the gospel. And we would see that word preach, we would see that as taking place behind that pulpit. But I want you to get this, and I'm standing away from it because I really want you to understand this, that the word preach here means to herald, to proclaim. Can I note something that each and every one of us have the ability to do? We have the ability to proclaim, to herald the message that Jesus, He died for the condemnation. He died for the sins of the world. And not only that, but He rose again to not only take the condemnation, but to give new life, and that He, in fact, is alive. And I am witness of that because of the life that has changed, because I'm not a quarterback. Instead, God has changed my life, and I have the privilege of getting to serve in this capacity. But even if that wasn't the case, even if I did end up going to being a quarterback for the New York Giants, which would have been a bummer, it would not have mattered, because if that's what God had intended, and yet my life had been changed because of the gospel, then how wonderful it would have been to be a witness for Him on that platform. But it does not matter. What God intends is for you and I to be heralds, for you and I to proclaim the good news that Jesus is in fact alive. That's not just for your pastor. That's not just for the people that you would say, well, you know, I'm not bold. I don't have charisma. I'm an introvert. I stammer. I stutter. You fill in the blank. Believe it or not, I'm kind of an introvert. You can laugh at that. A funny story. I feel like every pastor I talk to, they all say the same thing. Like, deep down inside, we're probably all more introverted by nature than extroverts. I get that talking to people can be scary. I get it. I understand that. I understand the fear that I'm not going to be able to clearly proclaim something or say something in a way that will make sense. I do. I fear that. I fear that every time I step behind the pulpit. But that doesn't matter. God didn't say, whatever your excuse is, okay, we understand that. No, no, no. God said, go and preach the gospel to every creature. Connecting to even this morning, there's not one person, and there's no one that we should not be willing to minister. There's no one that we should not be willing to talk to, that we should not be willing to preach the gospel to. The person who would come in looking very different from me, the person who's likely maybe even from across the aisle politically, or the person who's from another country, whatever, you fill in the blank, whatever, because sometimes we have all of these things that limit us, and we allow things to get in our way. Rather than just doing the thing that God has given us to do, He's given us the responsibility. Child of God, if your life has been changed by the gospel, you are to go and preach the gospel. Amen. Not just your pastor from this pulpit, but you can go and tell your testimony. If you're saying, I want to know how to proclaim, I don't really know how to be a witness. I don't really know how to share my faith. That's a phrase that's commonly used. Well, let me point you to your pastor as a resource who would then love to be able to equip you and love to be able to help you. But believe it or not, it's far easier than you could begin to imagine. Just tell what you know. It's exciting what God has done. And if you just tell them what God has done for you, oftentimes that's enough. My fear is this. I know that this isn't a missions conference, but do you have a missions conference? When do you do that?
October.
This coming October, you're going to have, well, potentially, you're going to have maybe some missionaries come in, and they're going to present their field and talk about where God has sent them. It's an incredible, it's exciting time. It's a joyful time. Our church, we only do the home missions conference, so we don't get to do a normal missions conference. But we have missionaries come through. You know, it's easy to get excited about what God is doing in other places. And maybe it's easy to even get excited by what your pastor's getting to, you know, maybe how your pastor's getting to meet with somebody this week. Or maybe how so-and-so got to meet with someone else and got to be a witness. And we hear of these things, and we may get excited. We may hoop and holler and be all in with what's going on. But the very real danger that I think can exist and does exist is that as we hear these things, that in some form or another, we begin to farm out, and I think I really believe this happens internally, that in some form or another, we farm out our responsibility to those that are going. And we farm out in our minds and in our hearts that it's these people that are going to do this, that it's them that are going to do this. And we profit from it in joy. I mean, it's exciting to hear about what God is doing. It's exciting whenever we hear of a soul getting saved. But the very real danger is that you and I, in some form or another, internally, that you and I would farm out our responsibility to go and to preach and to proclaim the gospel to somebody that we see as more qualified. You say, but you don't know who I am. You don't know what I've done. You don't know my weaknesses. Well, quick pause. Do you remember beginning of chapter 16? The messenger. Who did he say to go tell the good news to? Peter. Well, wait a minute. If you remember, for the readers of Mark, and even though I know all of us know this, but for the readers of Mark, they would have recalled, and I think you already know this, you would recall the fact that just prior to this, just before Jesus' death, Peter denies that he even knew Christ three times. Yeah. Can we just, I'm going to use very harsh terms, but it's true. He's a coward. He's a chicken. In many ways, he's a turncoat. Whatever name you, he's a yellow livered, you know, you just come up with some kind of Western, you know, name in John Wayne's voice. I can't do it. That's what Peter is. He denied that he even, matter of fact, it was to a little girl. I mean, we would tease Peter incessantly for this. I mean, Peter, seriously, you were denying it to a girl? You were afraid of what she would do? I mean, he denied the fact that he even knew Jesus three times. And yet I want you to get this. Who was the message for? The turncoat. The one who denied that he even knew Jesus. And guess who then was to go and tell? The turncoat who denied that he even knew Jesus. Can we point out one other narrative detail that is given to us? In just after all of that, whenever in verse number 9, Jesus meets with Mary Magdalene. And note what it specifically says. Out of whom he had cast seven devils. That's not just that's not just an accidental note. So that we're like, oh, that one. Okay. No. Out of whom he had cast seven devils. I want you to get this. It's easy for us to see demon possession and to say, man, they were a victim of what had taken place. Mary Magdalene, she would have been a victim of all that the demons, these devils would have put her through. And it's true. Her life would have been horrific as these seven devils, as these seven demons would have indwelt her. Her life would have been miserable. What took place would have been truly tragic. It would have been hard for you and I to see. But I want you to understand this, that in order for her to have even been possessed, for her to have even had these demons, there would have had to have been decisions that she would have made along the way that would have opened her up to this. So then, therefore, everything that came afterwards, even though she never desired to do those things, they were all still ultimately her responsibility because she had made the decisions to be in this position. And so, therefore, here she was wrecked by all of this. And yet, the Bible, we know the story, but Jesus had cast out these demons. And so now her life was changed. And guess what life, guess what mouth God wanted to use to proclaim the good news to the disciples? Amen. The one who had been unclean, who had been possessed by the devils. The one who, if you and I had seen, we would be in an alley or on a street, we would have gone to the opposite side of the street. We would have gone to the other side. If they're in Glendale, we're in Phoenix, Scottsdale, whatever, I don't know necessarily the towns, but we would have found some way to avoid them. We would have found some way to be in the opposite area of her because she would have been unclean. She would have scared us. We wouldn't want to be around her. And yet that's the one that Jesus wanted to use. That's the one that Jesus wanted, that not only wanted to use, but that the news was even for.
Yes. Wow. That's good.
But you don't know. I'm pretty sure that Mark 16 makes it clear that there's no one. There's no one that is excluded from this. Church, I'm going to say this in a funny way. Churches don't have farm teams. We don't. That means we don't have any right to farm out our responsibility to go and preach. But rather, that responsibility to go and tell is yours. It's yours. But can I just say that this way too? What a joy. We have the privilege, we have the joy of getting to tell that Jesus is not dead but is alive.
Amen. Yes.
So I say this in closing. Church, God intended you and I to be heralds, preachers of the gospel of Jesus Christ to those who've never heard and even to those who have heard. Don't farm out your responsibility to preach the gospel.